Hello and welcome to Subject to Change with me, Russell Hogg. My guest today is Frank de Cotter. Frank is the Chair Professor of Humanities at the University of Hong Kong, and he's best known, I think, for a truly remarkable series of books, prize-winning books, I should say, about communist China. And the first three books take us from the victory of the communists over the nationalists right up to the death of Mao. And there's now a fourth called China After Mao, The Rise of a Superpower. Anyway, Frank, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So your books really get into the detail, and the detail is pretty harrowing, I should say, of what happens during the Mao years. And you work a lot from archive material, so you're using a lot of primary sources. And in a podcast like we're doing today, we aren't going to be able to get into that kind of detail, but my idea was we could just touch on some of the stories and some of the narratives covered by the four books. And the first book, chronologically at least, I'm not sure if it was the first one you wrote, is called The Tragedy of Liberation. And that's a great title, by the way. I really like that, The Tragedy of Liberation. And that starts with the victory of the communists over the nationalists. And I've never been quite clear how that happens, because I know Chiang Kai-shek's armies have been fighting it out with the Japanese, and they've been really pounded by them. But doesn't he have better armies than the communists, and he's backed by the Americans and by the British?
It's a very good question, and I'm afraid that I myself I'm still not quite clear either. So you have to remember that the book really talks about something that has been portrayed in the literature by historians as a sort of golden age, 1949, red flag goes up over the Forbidden City in Beijing, all the way till the beginning of the Great Leap Forward, 1958. So it's roughly the first decade or so. But the introduction talks about what leads up to the conquest of that huge country from 45 to 49. It's a short chapter. And I'm still not quite capable of explaining it. What is so remarkable is that on many occasions, the nationalists had an opportunity to really get rid of the Communist Party. And one of those opportunities, there were quite a few before the start of the Second World War in 1937, when Japan invades. There are quite a few. But after the defeat of Japan in 1945, there's at least one point where the troops of the central government are in hot pursuit. And then, of course, as you know from that chapter, George Marshall, the one who gave his name to the Marshall Plan in Europe, intervenes and imposes a ceasefire, which allows the communists to more or less escape. But I think there are two other issues there which are very important, and also I think issues that have been very much overlooked by the literature. One is that Stalin, who, according to the Yalta agreements, invades through Siberia and makes his way to the 38th parallel in Korea, stays in Manchuria, the north of China, above the northern wall, strategically highly important. That's where the industry is too, and stays there for a good 6 months and helps Mao transform his ragtag army of guerrilla fighters into a formidable fighting machine with arsenals opened, with officers sent to Moscow for advanced training. So without Stalin, it would have been very difficult for Mao to prevail. And then there is something else. Once you start looking more closely, not so much at the battles or the strategy, but at the persistence of it, then you realize that it's very difficult to fight back. So I'll give you one very concrete example. Changchun, a large city in the north, which is surrounded by Lin Biao, one of Mao's foremost generals. And Lin Biao orders this city to be starved into surrender. He literally says in Chinese, "Ba Changchun bian cheng si cheng," turn Changchun into a city of death. So nobody can go in, nobody can come out. 160,000 casualties, most of them ordinary people, starved to death. Changchun falls. The same strategies apply to other cities in Manchuria, and of course, the general in charge of Beijing, which is not the capital, Nanjing is the capital, but the man in charge of Beijing decides to surrender because he does not wish Beijing, the ancient imperial capital of China, to undergo the same fate that has been imposed on Changchun and other cities. So it's that sheer desire to just crush and prevail of the communists. It's very difficult to resist. One day I was in Taipei reading through some of the archives of Chiang Kai-shek. It was a very interesting document where Chiang Kai-shek meets an American ambassador during the Korean War. And the ambassador tells him, you know, we find it very difficult in the Korean War. We find it very difficult to fight the Chinese because they will just keep on sending you their soldiers. You just can't fight. And then Chiang Kai-shek says, looks at him and says, well, if you and the United Nations are unable to fight the Chinese in Korea, how exactly did you expect me to fight them 2 years earlier? That's a very good question.
Yeah. It is bizarre that the Americans wanted the Russians to come in and put pressure on the Japanese. It feels like, well, you can sort of understand it, but the Americans were able to win that war on their own, and particularly with the atom bomb. But I suppose at that stage, they didn't know the atom bomb was necessarily going to come.
Exactly.
But it was a huge strategic error. But the communists don't just win through fighting power. They win as well because they must be popular. They must have popular support. So what is their program? What are they promising? And to what extent do they actually deliver on what they're promising?
Well, I beg to differ. I understand why you asked me the question, and I'm not saying it's a bad one. In fact, it's a very good one. The literature is replete, even by critics of communism, with this notion that somehow the communists do something that the nationalists don't, and that's land distribution. But here's the problem. The whole notion of land distribution, you know, you take from the rich, you distribute to the poor, is based on the Russian model. Now, if you look carefully at Russian history, what the Bolsheviks do after 1917 actually makes sense. Not that I'm in favor, but you have to look at the reality. The reality is that there are very large aristocratic estates on which a great number of very poor people labor, serfs, who have been only just emancipated. I think in the 1870s they've been emancipated. Before that they were literally slaves. So the contrast between so-called gentry, landlords in Russia, and this very poor people is huge. But there's no such thing in China.
Yeah,
there's no such thing like that under the empire before 1912, in the republic up till 1949. There simply isn't enough land that can be distributed. So the whole idea of communism is that you will take from rich landowners, distribute it to the poor will be happy and support you. So the whole history of communism in China from 21 onwards, but certainly from 1927 onwards, is an attempt to carry out this program, with the result that they are never able to make any territory under their control actually function. In effect, what the communists do in the 1920s and 30s, and to some extent the 1940s, is take a territory, impose their land distribution, which leads to the impoverishment of all involved, and then abandon the territory because it has been depredated and there's nothing left but misery and famine. So it's not just that you cannot take land from the rich, which doesn't exist, and give it to the poor. It is that very ordinary farmers become afraid of being portrayed as rich or middle farmers and will do the minimum. In other words, there's a general impoverishment of a territory controlled by communists before 1949. But what does happen is that once they start moving south from Manchuria, very much the north of Manchuria, from 1946-47 onwards, they can implement land reform. And they can recruit young people from the families who profit from land reform because they're constantly moving south. In other words, they no longer have to deal with the consequences of land reform and the impoverishment of the communities on which land reform is imposed, if that makes sense to you.
interesting. It's a bit like a plague of locusts moving south.
That's exactly what it is. It's like a sort of not so much deferred benefits, but deferred problems. That you can deal with the result of land reform much later once you have united and conquered that country. There's another point I wish to make, is that the literature goes on and on and on about land reform. But land reform, in effect, is not about really distribution of land. It is about a power structure. It is more specifically about compelling a majority of villagers. They're all frequently more or less in the same circumstances. If somebody's identified as rich, in the case of Yuanbao, a village all the way up in the north of Manchuria in 1947, where land reform starts, the so-called rich person just has a window pane in a mud hut. That's the difference between him and the other household.
Somebody's the landlord.
Yes. So exactly. He of course, he's not even a landlord. He just happens to be slightly wealthier than the others. But what the commoners do when they enter a village, the Red Army, they close it off and they compel, after a number of weeks, they closely observe who is who. They compel a majority of the villagers to denounce power holders. Whether they are landlords or not doesn't matter. And they must not just denounce these power holders, they must frequently assault them, and in some cases, kill them. And then the assets of these power holders are distributed to the crowd. And in other words, land reform is a way of making sure that the majority of villagers have blood on their hands, and as a result, have profited from this crime, and as a result, are unlikely to want the nationalists to come back. So that's really is the key. So land reform is the revolution. Land reform is the killing, literally, of the power holders and the substitution of their power for the power of the Communist Party. That's really the key to the whole process.
And even before we get into the Great Leap Forward, villages are being collectivized and they're being forced to sell their grain to the state. And as I understand it, they're being prevented from moving. And you were talking about Russia and how land reform worked in the Russian Revolution, where people were kind of serfs. But it feels like in China, the villagers are being turned into serfs. It seems almost the reverse process.
Yes, of course, but this is true for all communism, in the sense that once, not just under Lenin, but in particular under Stalin from 1928-29 onwards, with collectivization in the countryside, of course, these villagers who are supposedly who have been supposedly liberated by the Bolshevik Revolution 1917 do become bonded servants. This is the case with all communist regimes. And the key is to understanding why both Stalin and Mao and later Pol Pot and, of course, the Kim family want to do that. And I think the answer is quite straightforward. Stalin, like Mao, like others, wants the grain produced by the farmers to go straight into state granaries. And they want to use that grain to sell it on the international market, to raise currency and use the currency to buy turnkey factories. So that's modernization. You must obtain foreign currency to buy the big factories that you need to turn your largely agricultural country into a modern, industrialized international power. That's what Stalin wants, and he obtains it. And that's what Mao wants, and he also obtains it to some extent. So the result is, of course, that if you collectivize the countryside, you can tell the farmers what they should grow, and you can take all the grain, and you can sell the grain, and the butter, and the meat, and everything else you extract from the countryside. But, of course, the result is that you cause famine on a massive scale in the Soviet Union in the early 1930s, in the case of the People's Republic of China from 58 to 62. In the case of Mao, Great Leap Forward, at least 45 million people starved to death during a period of 4 years. Very hard to comprehend.
Stalin, he dies in 1953, and bizarrely, up to then, he's almost been holding Mao back from... He's sort of saying you're doing too much too soon. Perhaps he's learned, I don't know, from his own failures.
Yes.
And there's another disaster for China, which is that Khrushchev comes along. He replaces Stalin. And then is it 56? He denounces Stalin.
Yes.
And Mao sees this as a direct challenge on him, I think.
Yes. Yes. So two things happen. You're quite right. Stalin dies. Stalin's death is Mao's liberation. There's only one man capable of restraining him, and that is Stalin, because Stalin determines the amount of aid, financial and otherwise, that the People's Republic of China gets. The Soviet Union is the PRC's main supporter. So when he dies, at long last, Mao can really accelerate collectivization. So by 1955, pretty much all commerce and trade have become functions of the state. Whether you're a small shopkeeper or a large industrialist, all of this has now been nationalized. By 55, most farmers are in collective farms. And by 58, they're herded into these giant collectives called people's communes. So that's point one. Point two, Khrushchev, 1956, 3 years after Stalin's death, gives this speech in February, pretty much denouncing his erstwhile master and starting what is later on referred to as de-Stalinization. And Mao, of course, sees this as a direct assault on him for two reasons. First, Mao believes he is very much the Stalin of China. But secondly, he also thinks after the death of Stalin, he, Mao, really ought to take on the mantle of leadership of the socialist camp. So Stalin isn't just head of the Soviet Union, he's head of the entire socialist camp. And Mao thinks that role should be his. And Khrushchev is just a minor figure from his point of view. So when Khrushchev starts his whole speech, against the cult of personality, against the crimes committed by Stalin, the speech is used by some of his colleagues to hem Mao in. And that will have very grave consequences. To fast forward, this not only leads to the Great Leap Forward, but it also leads to the Cultural Revolution. The cult of personality, Mao Zedong thought, is written out of the constitution by the end of 1956. It will be re-inscribed into the constitution more than 10 years later at the height of the Cultural Revolution, when Mao has eliminated a great many of the people he thinks stood in his way. So the consequences are, enormous.
So the Great Leap Forward, how does the Great Leap Forward differ from what's gone on before? Because already collectivization has started. So what's changing with the Great Leap Forward?
Yes. Well, I have called it radical collectivization in the sense that by 55, 56, most farmers are already part of collectives, but they are herded into giant collectives called people's communes. Now, you got to remember one thing. In a collective, whether it's in the Soviet Union or elsewhere, a family can still cook their own food. They have their own home. But the model of the people's communes, to which people are herded in 1958, are very much based on the army. In other words, people go to collective canteens. Children are sent to collective kindergartens. People sleep in collective dormitories. The whole fabric of ordinary family life is broken. In effect, what is the Great Leap Forward? It is an attempt by Mao to transform every man and every woman in the countryside into a foot soldier in a giant army that he hopes can work day and night to transform the economy and then help China overtake all its rivals, in particular the Soviet Union. So the Great Leap Forward, the people's communes, is also basically turning people not just into bonded servants, but into people who work day and night, like the military.
I want to say a bit more about the starvation, but it's not just starvation. There's huge violence as well against the villagers, is there not?
Yes.
I mean, there's a lack of, once you've got everybody in the communes, yeah, these super communes, there's no incentive to work, right? So
exactly.
So they use violence to make them work?
Well, that's exactly it. There is a spiral of violence when you have, on the one hand, local cadres, representatives of the party, who must whip up the villagers in one drive after the other, a drive to increase grain production, increase iron production, wood, you name it, cotton. And on the other hand, of course, the villagers who no longer have any incentive to work, the grain they produce is taken by the state, it's taken away. The schedule is no longer theirs. They don't have any tools, kitchen utensils. They're dished out some meager rations on the basis of ration coupons and collective canteens. Whether they work very hard or not doesn't really make all that much of a difference. So gradually, in order to fulfill these quotas, cadres on the ground have no alternative but to start using violence to make people work. In children, men, women forced to work in the middle of the winter half naked, people thrown into ponds for stealing a potato, people punished for not working hard enough or sleeping during a meeting. It goes on and on. Violence becomes a way of life, becomes a way of really trying to achieve these quotas. So you could say there are no figures. You cannot come up with a number here. But you could say that roughly 2-3%, possibly 4, possibly 5, those are very vague numbers, but a certain percentage of people do not die of hunger. They're quite literally beaten to death. And then there's something else. If you die of hunger, it may not be because there's no food around. Food is, of course, taken away by state agents. But it may be because you have been punished. Food is used as a weapon. So rather than beat someone, the first weapon of choice of local cadres is simply to ban a person from the canteen if you don't work hard enough. If you're a woman and you're pregnant and you cannot turn up in the fields, you are banned from the canteen, which means that you cannot eat, which means that you starve to death.
And you reckon 45 million through famine and through deliberate being starved to death.
Yes, I don't give a figure. A number of historians have come up with numbers, 36 or 38 or 23. I think it's not possible to come up with a number. So what I say is at least 45 million. A number of historians, local historians, by the way, not foreign, and the local historians have ventured the number of 50 million. I just say at least 45 million.
Just going back, I mean, we're talking about the violence. Even at the start, there was even quotas when they were doing the land reform. There was quotas, wasn't there, for killing, I don't know what you would call, enemies of the state.
Yes,
or,
yes. Yes, it's one per thousand. It's October 1950, campaign to eliminate counter-revolutionaries, bandits, and all other enemies of the revolution is started by Chairman Mao. It will last a year. How do you determine the number of people to be either reformed or disposed of? He comes up with a quota, and he calls it one per thousand. He says you can go a little bit beyond, but you shouldn't really go too much beyond. So the problem here is that the two interesting points. One is that throughout communism, governance is frequently through quotas, and it remains the case to this day. When we talk about China after Mao, the 1980s, 90s, all the way till today, the number, the quota you must fulfill is, of course, GDP. If you are a party secretary, a large city or a province, you must reach the proverbial 7 or 8%, which is, you know, determined by the state. So when you and I talk about GDP, it's something that you calculate. It's the result of an economic activity. Whereas in the People's Republic of China, it is a quota. You do not obtain it, you will fail, you don't get a promotion. So, of course, under Mao, this goes back and has all sorts of repercussions. It is a way of deciding how many people should die, how many people should live, how many go to prison, you know, what amount of grain should be confiscated. It goes on and on and on. The quotas at every level. But to go back to the one per thousand, of course, the tragedy here, or rather the iron logic of it, is that a number of local officials at the level of a village, but all the way up to the level of an entire province, if you govern a province, you might wish to shine, show that you are more determined than others are to fulfill the wishes of the chairman and defend the cause of revolution, meaning that you will not just kill one per thousand, you'll proudly proclaim that you've been able to kill two per thousand or three per thousand. With the result that if you start looking at the archives, extremely detailed cases, in many cases, people who are entirely innocent, not by our standards, but by the standards of the regime at the time, a great many are simply massacred in order for that quota to be reached locally, in a city, in a county, in a province. That's really, truly frightening.
One of the more disturbing photos in one of your books is people just lying, you know, bound with their hands bound and having been shot. I guess that's that was one of the more shocking photos.
Well, as Chairman Mao said, revolution is no dinner party.
So, what brings the Great Leap forward? Why does it go on so long, and why does it end?
Well, it's very difficult to climb down when you stake your own reputation on the Great Leap Forward. And when you, for instance, go to the airport to meet Nikita Khrushchev, and then you explain to him that the Great Leap Forward is such a great success that you have too much grain and you don't know what to do with it, as Khrushchev recounts in his memoirs. And you just can't believe it. He just staggers. How can you say that? But when you make such claims about the Great Leap Forward, it's very difficult to climb down and accept that this is a disaster. So the point is reached where in 1961, a number of people who Mao trusts manage to convey the message that this is no longer going anywhere at all, and that what he is facing is a catastrophe on a gigantic scale. So at that point, some of the more radical aspects of the Great Leap Forward are pruned back. A little bit more leeway is given to villagers to look after themselves. For instance, as in the Soviet Union, families do nominally have the right to cultivate a very small private plot. Now that, of course, is allowed again, was forbidden during the Great Leap Forward. So what you see is very gradually the economy moves away from that radical collectivization, and people manage to survive by going back to very old-fashioned modes of production, which is basically the private market and trade. And you can see where this will be going. Mao must accept it in 62, 63, but will soon denounce it as a return to capitalism that must be wiped out. That's your beginning of the Cultural Revolution.
And you talked about Mao's cult of personality, and I was reading another of your books, How to Be a Dictator, and it was talking about Mao's cult of personality. And I was thinking about the dictators. You've got the fascist dictators. Hitler, you know, with this, you know, looks like a maniac with his horrible moustache. And, you know, just extremely unattractive looking figure, you know, however great a speaker he may have been. You got Mussolini, who's sort of short and fat and something of a buffoon. But then you've got Stalin, you know, this sort of strong, authoritative, you know, great moustache, kindly twinkle in his eye. You've got Mao. He's always seen, you know, you always, when I think of Mao, I see this man in his communist sort of blue suit with always smiling, looking into the distance, you know, into the future with, you know, grateful, smiling people around him. Somehow the communists are better at projecting their image But Mao's cult of personality becomes almost insane, doesn't it?
Yes, it's true. Having said that, all of them are masters at cultivating their own image, and all of them are of course, also great actors. So not only Hitler, but Mussolini also. In an unguarded moment, Hitler says, "I am Europe's greatest actor." Mussolini says the same thing. But by the way, the moustache, Hitler hires a photographer who will become his photographer and very strictly control his image, Heinrich Hoffmann. When he hires him, Heinrich Hoffmann says, "Do you know that moustache of yours? Are you sure?" And Hitler says, "Well, don't you worry about that. It will be my trademark." And, of course, he's absolutely right. It remains trademark to this very day. But these are very astute people. It's a big mistake to poo-poo dictators and describe them as, you know, sort of
buffoons.
Unintelligent buffoons. They will read you and understand you and gauge you and take the measure of you well before you even realize it. And they will manipulate you without you even knowing it. So the point about Mao's cult of personality is that it is quite comparable to Stalin. Communists are very good at that, as you point out. But the point is that from 1966, with the start of the Cultural Revolution, it really becomes just incredible. And the reason for that, I think, is quite straightforward. Cult of personality has many functions. In particular, in the communist regime, it is important to realize that whether you are in Bolshevik Russia in 1917 or whether you are in China in 1949 or Korea 45, it's important to realize that the vast majority of the population is not exactly taken in by the philosophy of dialectical materialism. In other words, the basics of Marxism are incomprehensible, and they are to me to this very day. You know, never mind people who work with their hands and have other things to do all day long. So there is a need for something else, and that's, of course, to call it a personality, where people can appeal to some father figure, to some important person out there. But most of all, cult of personality is there to make sure that everyone, including people in the immediate entourage of a dictator, whether it's Stalin or Hitler or Mao, proclaim their loyalty to the leader. And when they do so, when everybody proclaims their blind loyalty to the leader, it becomes very difficult to find out who might be opposed to the man in power. So it becomes much more difficult to actually organize a coup or a conspiracy. If you think that all the people around you adore the man in charge, how do you find out what they really think? It's a very difficult thing to do. Now, the key point about the Cultural Revolution is that Mao wishes to destroy what he thinks are remnants of what he calls capitalist, bourgeois, feudal, superstitious culture. Here's the problem for him. In 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution succeeds in confiscating the assets of the capitalist class. But the problem is, according to him, people like Khrushchev are still contaminated by capitalist ideas. In other words, capitalist ideas are still there. So what Mao will do is carry out the second step in the world revolution. The Bolsheviks confiscated the assets of the communists, of the capitalists. Mao will now have a revolution against the culture of the capitalists, which is very much the basis of the Cultural Revolution. You know, get rid of bourgeois novels, pianos, music, anything that smacks of the past or capitalism. But then the question is, what you substitute it with, of course, the answer is proletarian culture. But what is proletarian culture? Of course, people realize very quickly the safest thing for you is to follow the Mao cult. The Mao cult. So rather than buy a teacup that might have an image of Mickey Mouse, which is pretty much a taboo, or have a teacup which might have an image of a red flag, is much safer if you have a teacup that has Mao's face on it. Then you will be secure. So you get Mao's face everywhere, every object. Get Mao slogans everywhere. Mao portraits, Mao busts, Mao speeches. You will hear them in the street, in the bus. It's everywhere. You can't escape it. You cannot escape Mao in the privacy of your own home. By 1968, people bow to his portrait, perform a little loyalty dance. The whole point of a cult of personality is that a dictator cannot police every single person. You can't put a policeman behind everyone. But with the cult of personality, people start policing not just each other, but themselves. They become afraid of thinking thoughts which might be negative about their leader. They might denounce each other for doing things which might indicate lack of loyalty towards the leader. In fact, during the Cultural Revolution, they must prove their loyalty to the chairman by denouncing others, including friends, colleagues at work, possibly even family members.
For some reason, I feel that the Great Famine or the Great Leap Forward, everybody knows it was a disaster, but somehow there's something viscerally more upsetting to Westerners about the Cultural Revolution. Maybe it's the destruction of all this history, all these cultural artifacts. Maybe it's because we have these photos of people with placards around their heads, you know, with their heads bowed, you know, with a baying mob around them. But there's something more viscerally upsetting somehow about the Cultural Revolution. I'm not quite sure why, because the number of actual deaths, you know, people are killed in the Cultural Revolution, but it's not on the same scale.
Absolutely. It's probably somewhere between 1 and 2 million over a period of 10 years. So that's nothing compared to the campaign of terror that was waged in the early years. You remember the killing quota of 1,000, where you get about 2 million killed from 1950 to 51. Never mind at least 45 million during the Great Leap Forward. So the point about the Cultural Revolution is it's not loss of life. It is loss of dignity, loss of trust in other people, loss of faith in a future, loss of certainty about life, just loss at every level, and loss, of course, of friendship and loyalty and everything like that. But you ask me why, I think this may sound very crude, and I apologize, but when you say Soviet Union, I think most Europeans will think communist, Bolshevik, political system, gulags, not too good. But the moment you say People's Republic of China, what one hears in Europe is China. And when you hear China, you think culture. And when you hear culture, you think, oh, this is good. Chinese culture is long, you know. Poetry, paintings have been around for 5,000 years. It's all wonderful. So to put it in a very blunt manner, when tens of millions of ordinary farmers die, not sure too many people in Europe care, and Chinese culture is attacked, that's something different.
One of the things that sort of strikes me about Mao and about the communists is that they seem to be great at slogans. And I guess slogans are important when you're dealing with a world without a way of really getting the news out. You want to simplify your message. But their slogans are great. I mean, and they have so many. And is this a communist thing? Was this an imperial Chinese thing? Are there similarities between the imperial system and the communist system? Is there any kind of continuity?
No, I don't think. I'm not a firm believer in things Chinese. I'm a firm believer in individuals. And I think the point I'm making here is the individual responsible for so many of these extraordinary slogans is the chairman himself. Let's give him some credit. He is a master at coming up with very pithy slogans. And it starts very early in his career. 5th of January 1930, a single spark can set the prairie alight. Wonderful. About how revolution can be carried out, and it can start in a small corner of the realm, but it will set the whole country alight. It's a fantastic thing. Power comes from the barrel of a gun, a very succinct way of putting the whole history of communism into a mere sentence.
Yes.
And it goes on and on. He's a master at it. I defy you to come up with a single slogan from the People's Republic of China over the last 20 years that you find attractive. There isn't one. Oh, it really is Mao. It really is Mao. He's very good at it. I'm not sure about his poetry, but he was very good with words.
That 100 Flowers Bloom was another of his.
Another wonderful one.
So you credit Mao with that. Do we also credit his personality, his paranoia, his, I don't know what you would say, evil. Don't quite know what the word is. But do we credit Mao with the disaster that was communist China up to the death of Mao? Is that his personality? Is it defects in him? Or is there something sort of systematic at work which one way or another was going to lead to this?
Yeah, I understand. It's a very good one. It's a very complicated one. Of course, you know what the answer is. There is no answer. It's a very complex sort of balance between personality on the one hand, circumstances, and of course the larger system of communism. The communist system is very tremendously, and not just from one country to another, you know, very often the temptation is to compare Chinese communism versus Soviet communism. But, you know, the Russia under Khrushchev is very different from the Russia under Stalin, as you can imagine, never mind the Russia under Brezhnev. So things change tremendously within single countries. In Poland under communism, it was not uncommon at all for quite a number of ordinary farmers to actually own the land, which is unheard of in the case of the People's Republic of China. Those are quite common for small enterprises and restaurants to be run by single families in Poland in the 1980s, also unheard of in the case of the People of China, at least until Deng Xiaoping. So it's very difficult, but you know, I don't see this in terms of good points, bad points. I'm not there to make a judgment. The point for me is to accept that he was an extraordinary individual, like many dictators who last. They have a great many talents. The problem is that many listeners or readers will probably not find these talents very appealing. For instance, one talent he must have as a dictator is an ability to be entirely unmoved by the deaths of millions. If that keeps you up at night, if I say something wrong to a colleague in my department, that might keep me up at night. So did I say something wrong? Was I maybe unkind? But if you kill millions, if not tens of millions, and that keeps you up at night, you're not a good dictator. So you should be really entirely unsympathetic towards other human beings. You must be able to manipulate others. And Mao was a master manipulator. He really knew how to pit people against each other. Even close allies who had known him for decades fell into that trap during the Cultural Revolution. So in that sense, like other dictators, he has a whole range of extraordinary talents. And you must give him something else. Like Stalin, although Stalin, of course, died in a pool of his own urine. Mao did die in his own bed of natural death. So he may have killed tens of millions. He may have crushed the lives of many more. But the prize for him is that he remained in charge until the very last moment. And not only that, he put up a system in which his portrait is still there on Tiananmen Square. His face is still staring at you from every bill in the People's Republic. Well, that's a major achievement.
So he dies, when he dies, is it 76? 76. So Mao dies in 76. But as I read your books, even then, I take what you say about his achievement in sort of staying in charge and so on. But things have slightly slipped away in that just sheer practical necessity. People are starting to do their own thing, aren't they, to try and make the system work, you know, behind the screen, so to speak.
Yes, you're quite right. And I'm not entirely sure that it bothers the chairman very much. What he has achieved with the death of Lin Biao.
And who is he, sir?
He's pretty much number two. He's enabled the Cultural Revolution. He's the author of the Little Red Book, Quotations from the Chairman. He dies in a mysterious plane accident, no doubt killed on the orders of Zhou Enlai in September 71. The key point is that when Lin Biao dies, the army is purged in turn. So the Cultural Revolution, in a nutshell, 66 to 68, Mao uses the people to purge the party. 68 to 71, Mao uses the army to purge. 66, 68, Mao uses the people to purge the party. Then he uses the army to purge the people, many of them sent to the countryside, including Red Guards. But then in turn, with the death of Lin Biao, the army is purged. I think from that point onwards, Mao is reasonably content. He's reasonably certain that there will no longer be any challenge to his power. Whether the challenge is imaginary or not is a different story. His enemies might be real, they might be entirely imaginary. This man is paranoid, like every person who is in power, because nobody will tell him the truth, so you start to imagine plots and conspiracies everywhere. He's completely paranoid, no doubt about it. But nonetheless, in his paranoid mind, it doesn't seem to be a very plausible threat from there onwards. He's reasonably content. But what happens? When the army is purged in 72, ordinary people in the countryside realize that since the party has been purged, and since the army has been purged, there's no longer anyone to strictly enforce the dictates of the party in the countryside. There's nobody there to tell you you will grow grain and you will give the grain to the grain inspector who will confiscate it on behalf of the state. So very gradually, tens of millions upon tens of millions of villagers start very quietly going back to their past. They start trading on black markets. They start opening underground factories. They start traveling around the country. They start making decisions about what they want to plant on their own soil. They start taking back the land and the tools. They start undermining the people's communes. And this trend only accelerates after the death of Mao with Deng Xiaoping. So to fast forward, Deng Xiaoping gives a little bit of leeway to the people's communes, believing that if they are allowed to retain any surplus over and above the procurement quotas that the state gives to the people's communes, then these people's communes will thrive. He thinks this will be an incentive. But of course, the people's communes don't do this at all. They take these contracts, give them to the villagers give them to households. Before you know it, the land is divided. The people's communes collapse, undermined from below, in 1982. That's the end of the people's communes. The people, quite literally, in the countryside, have lifted themselves out of poverty by 1982-83. They've doubled their income within a few years.
I can't remember where this phrase comes from, but it's a phrase to match one of Mao's, which is, it doesn't matter what color the cat is, so long as it catches mice.
Yes.
There's this sort of ambivalence, certainly in more modern China, between capitalism and communism.
Yeah.
So can you talk a bit about that?
Yes. It's of course a phrase that goes back to Deng Xiaoping, but I think it's very misleading. All the evidence shows that not only Mao, but every successor, whether it's Deng Xiaoping, whether it's Jiang Zemin, Hu Jintao, or the man in charge today, the man who bears an uncanny resemblance to Winnie the Pooh.
Don't say it.
All of them are committed to Marxism-Leninism. In fact, the very man who came up with the black cat, white cat, has the four cardinal principles inscribed into the Constitution of 1982. Whether the four cardinal principles, everybody should know these by heart. You can basically boil it down to two, but it means uphold the socialist way, which is the socialist economy, which is not capitalism. uphold the socialist way, uphold the leadership of the party, which means there will be no elections, there will be no other party, uphold Marxism, Leninism, Mao Zedong thought, and uphold the dictatorship of the proletariat. A dictatorship of the proletariat, in case you find it Marx's vocabulary confusing, means it is not a dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. That's where you and I are. That's called, you and I would call that a democracy. So the four cardinal principles, which are repeated time and again by every leader after Deng Xiaoping has it inscribed in the Constitution in 1982, these are the guiding principles. So in effect, something else happens from Deng Xiaoping onwards, is that while there is tremendous change, some of it not at all anticipated by the party, for instance, the collapse of the people's communes in the countryside in 1982, not anticipated at all. It's not at all a goal that Deng Xiaoping pursued. On the contrary, he believed that a collectivized economy is the backbone of the socialist agriculture in the countryside. He repeats it time and again. But the point really is, whatever it is they do with the economy, they are committed all the way till today to maintaining a very Marxist principle. One of the four cardinal principles in the Constitution says uphold the socialist way, it means, in effect, in Marxist parlance, I apologize, that the state must control the means of production. Now, what are the means of production? Some of your listeners might find this confusing. It basically, in Marxist parlance, it means everything that goes into the production process. So if you want to grow a carrot in the countryside, you must have land. That's a means of production. Fertilizer, labor, a warehouse. All of these are means of production. Energy, etc. Same with a factory. All of these means of production must be controlled by the state. So to this very day, the land belongs to the state. Unlike Poland, you may remember what I said about Poland in the 1980s. Mm. Mm. Capital must belong to the state. In other words, all the banks are state banks. You must deposit your money in a bank that belongs to the state. The state then decides what to do with your savings, not the market. Electricity belongs to the state, is distributed by the state. Raw materials are controlled by the state. Large enterprises are controlled by the state, directly or indirectly. So in pure Marxist parlance, the state, to this very day, is a Marxist state. It is a socialist economy. It is not a capitalist economy by any description.
But are prices not being set by the market? Is that not what makes a market economy?
Of course. I understand what you mean. You mean that if I cross the border from Hong Kong into Shenzhen, I can go to a market and buy a T-shirt or a carrot, and the market will determine the price. I couldn't agree more. The question is, where does the T-shirt come from? Does it come from a small little private enterprise which has zero clout, or does it come from a very large state enterprise? Now, let's say that it comes from a very large state enterprise, and I, as a foreigner, wish to compete, and I set up a factory next door. It will be very difficult for me to compete, and I'll tell you why. Because the state enterprise will get endless subsidies from the state, which is why it is a state enterprise. The state might decide to subsidize energy provided for next to free. The state might decide to give the land for free. The state might decide to curb labor and make it available for very little. No unionized labor, by the way. The state might decide to provide cotton, the raw materials that go into a T-shirt, at a subsidized rate. There might be tax rebates, etc., etc., etc. So there is a point where it becomes quite pointless to talk about a market versus a state-controlled economy. In effect, the state does control most of the levers of the economy. So while it may be true that there are very small sort of, little private enterprises here and there, ultimately, the economy is controlled by the state. But these small, tiny little private enterprises, they can get away with quite a bit during certain periods and with less during other periods. You might say, throughout the 1990s, some of these small enterprises grew into very large ones. Well, I don't disagree. But the point surely must be that from the year 2000 onwards, under Jiang Zemin, every private enterprise must have a party committee. That doesn't mean that the two people who make T-shirts in the living room must set up a party committee. But it does mean that any major enterprise must have a party committee, and the party committee makes all the major decisions. So by 2004, some 94 or 95% of the 94 to 95% of the assets of the 500 largest enterprises actually belong to the state.
Dear God.
In other words, when we talk about private versus state, it is no longer a distinction which is very meaningful from roughly 2000 onwards, basically coincides with the WTO.
How does China get into the WTO? That never has made sense to me. They have systematically stolen intellectual property quite openly.
Yes.
Why are they allowed in? I just don't understand it.
Well, you will have to ask the Bill Clintons and others of this world who were very much behind it. But the decision is made in 1999. China joins the WTO in 2001. There are two parts of it. On the one hand, it is very clear that the People's Republic of China makes endless promises about greater transparency in governance, about greater respect of the rule of law, about implementing copyright law. There's pledges and promises, plenty of them, which will not be respected. On the other hand, it is also true that the Americans and many others somehow believe, it's a matter of ideology, like communist ideology, it's a matter of ideology. They believe that if only China were to join the WTO, then inevitably they will become a responsible stakeholder. The key ideology is that if there is economic reform, it will inevitably lead to political reform. That's the ideology.
But they've already had the example of Tiananmen Square, where it's absolutely brutal putting down of... I don't know quite what it was a putting down of exactly what they were putting down, how big a threat it was to them, but it was...
Yeah. I understand. You might think that sending 100,000 soldiers and 200 tanks to crush the population of Beijing in 1989, you've got to remember the tanks are Chinese tanks. I say this because in Budapest, 56, in Prague, 68, these were not local tanks, you know. These were tanks that came from the socialist camp. They were not Hungarian tanks in Budapest. But these are Chinese tanks used in Chinese people. You might think that would give you pause for reflection. That might lead one to think, is this really a very promising regime? So it goes back to what I said earlier on. You will remember you asked me why is it that fewer people care in Europe and the United States about the Great Leap Forward as compared to the Cultural Revolution. So it's about culture. China is equal culture. So the idea here is, I think, that these Chinese communists are not really communists. That Tiananmen is just an unfortunate case not to be compared to Budapest or Czechoslovakia, 68. That somehow, if you just help these people go along, then they will become just like you and me. That communism isn't really a Chinese thing at all. Well, I would say it's a great mistake. Again, I would say, read the Constitution. Read the four cardinal principles. Listen to what the leaders say, because they speak very clearly. And they phrase their opposition to the separation of powers and democracy extremely clearly. So why did nobody listen? It's a very good question. I think that's it. That's pretty much it. The belief that we know better than the Chinese leaders. You shouldn't really listen to what they have to say. They must say that. We know better.
People perhaps are learning. One thing that's interested me is I read an article that you wrote about the opium situation and indirectly the opium wars, but I get the sense that the Chinese people are extremely proud of what their country has achieved this last 20, 30 years. And they view it as sort of their time after centuries of domination by Western powers. And is that a fair assessment of reality? Is this propaganda? What's your take on this idea of Western domination and now the humiliation is being thrown off?
Well, you know, I once did an interesting test. You know, you always hear this stuff about humiliation and all these pronouncements about how this or that hurts the feelings of the Chinese people. So if you actually Google the sentence, hurts the feelings of, or you Google humiliation, you'll find out that it doesn't appear very often across the world except for the People's Republic of China. So is it because the feelings of the people in the People's Republic are more easily hurt than elsewhere? Is it because they've been more humiliated than, I don't know, say, Africa? Or India, which is a colony. So I think you understand what I'm trying to say here. It's human history isn't all that pretty. And I wouldn't single out China as the only and unique example of people who have undergone some sort of injustice. Of course, large parts of the globe have gone through far worse, in particular Africa, and large parts of the People's Republic of China. But the key point really is that this is very much state propaganda, very much propped up by state propaganda, which incessantly emphasizes this whole sense of humiliation. And this is particularly true from the moment that the tanks moved out of Beijing in 1989, when Jiang Zemin, who is in charge, emphasizes patriotic education. And he is the one who in 1989 starts emphasizing, puts his finger on the opium wars and turns Lin Zexu, the commissioner who burned a great amount of opium in the first opium war back in the 1830s, 40s, turns him into a national hero. From that moment onwards, it becomes part of the curriculum in every school, every kindergarten, every university. And it becomes inescapable. It is drilled into people day in, day out, the sense of humiliation and this need to be patriotic and proud of one's country. That's where we are now.
I guess we should wrap it up now. But I have one last question I'm interested in. Because there was a little anecdote in your book which struck me very strongly, which was Mrs. Thatcher visited Beijing, and she was somewhat horrified by what she saw as the ignorance of even the top leadership in Beijing of economic matters.
Yes.
How economically sophisticated are the, or were the Chinese leadership? And I guess my question is, Chinese success just catch up with a slave army? Or were the Chinese leadership sufficiently economically sophisticated to sort of achieve what they appear to have achieved today?
I think Stalin got it right and Thatcher got it right. And as you can tell from my choice, I'm not exactly partisan when it comes to politics. I'm not exactly in favor of the Tories or Labour or Republicans or Democrats. I think I loathe politicians in equal measure. But Stalin in 1949... Had a good cold look at Mao, and he described him as a caveman Marxist, and he got that right. And Thatcher, when she came back from Beijing, stopped here in Hong Kong and said in a private meeting, I won't try to imitate her accent, I'm Dutch. She said, I don't think these people have got the faintest clue of how an economy in the free world actually operates. And she was entirely right. A few years later, after she says this, we have a man called Wang Bingqian, who for years is in charge of the budget, and he doesn't really know any of the most basic accounting rules. The man in charge of the Bank of China, Li Guixian, is described by Li Rei, whose diaries on the Hoover Institution, man placed very high up, described Li Guixian, head of the bank, as somebody who isn't really aware of how banking operations actually performed. You know, incomings, outgoings, doesn't quite know how to do all of this. There's one principle you got to bear in mind. It's always politics first. So let me rephrase this slightly. I've read a great many documents from the 1980s and 90s, all the way up till 2008, in fact, from people who work in banks in China. And they know exactly what the problem is. They know exactly what is wrong with their model. And they phrase it in a very clear, sophisticated manner. But they are not the ones in charge. The ones in charge are inevitably, however good the advice is provided by the bankers and the specialists, the man, really woman, the man in charge, are always the caveman Marxists. They're the ones that make the decisions.
Well, that's a slightly sobering note, I guess, we're going to end on. Before I let you go, and thank you so much. That was really terrific. Thank you. I can't thank you enough. But before I let you go, I just thought I'd ask. I'd ask what you're working on at the moment.
Yes, absolutely. It goes back to the very first question you asked. How did they manage? How did you get from 12 chaps in a room, the foundation of the Communist Party of China in 1921 in Shanghai, how do you get from 12 chaps in a room in 1921 to a red flag fluttering over the Forbidden City in 1949? How did they manage to conquer a quarter of humanity? That's my question. And I'm working on it now. In other words, not a sequel, but a prequel to the People's Trilogy. The foundation of the Communist Party all the way up till 1949. And hopefully that will answer your question in a more satisfactory manner.
Okay, we'll leave it there. And again, thank you so much. That was brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's the end of today's podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, then I have a big favor to ask. I don't look to make any money from the podcast. There's no advertising or anything like that. I just do this because I enjoy speaking to the guests and, you know, I'm keen for them to get as big a audience as possible because I think, you know, they are really, really good people. So if you could share it on whatever social media channel you use, tweet it out, whatever it is, and even better, if you could leave a review on iTunes, that would be absolutely fantastic. Anyway, goodbye for now.